Monitor, fourth hour. Monitor, a continuing service in sound, a new dimension in radio. Monitor bringing you your story. Yours because you wrote it. Part of it, at least. 18 seconds past the hour. The hour, not a long segment of time as a man's life is measured, but long enough to bring many changes since last we monitored the news. And now, from the Monitor newsroom, John Cameron Swayze.
Here, in brief, are the top news stories of the hour. President Eisenhower told his news conference this morning that a top-level Big Four meeting might clarify the atmosphere in the world and also test Russia's sincerity. Meanwhile, at Warsaw, Soviet Premier Bulganin told a Russian satellite conference that the Soviet Union will give the West's invitation careful study. At Paris, the NATO Council wound up its meeting expressing a hope that hostilities cease in the Far East. And in the war on polio, the U.S. Public Health Service reports that the number of polio cases among persons vaccinated with the Salk vaccine now is 62. From the sports world, a few items. Two major league games are underway right now. But the big news of the day is the return of Ted Williams to the Boston Red Sox. A financial settlement with his recently divorced wife paved the way for the 36-year-old slugger's return to the Boston club on Friday. At Wrigley Field in Chicago, the Brooklyn Dodgers are trying to win their 12th straight victory, their 23rd victory in 25 games. And at the moment, the score is 0-0 in the top of the second inning. The Pittsburgh Pirates are playing the Braves at Milwaukee. The game is in the bottom of the first inning at the moment, and the score, Pittsburgh leads 2-0. All the games in the American League are just getting underway. It's Cleveland at New York, Chicago at Boston, Detroit at Washington, and Kansas City at Baltimore. Two night games, both in the National League. Giants at Cincinnati and the Phillies at St. Louis.
Monitor reports the weather over the nation. Generally, the weather is fair and mild. In the northeast, a weak high-pressure area has moved in, bringing with it warm temperatures and mostly fair skies. And fair weather is in prospect for the next 36 hours. In the southeast, the high-pressure area has stalled for the moment against a warm air mass, causing scattered showers in the Kentucky and Tennessee areas. In the west, a series of low-pressure systems are causing local clouds and showers. From coast to coast, temperatures are mild, with a maximum of 60 expected, except in the northern half of New England and the Great Lakes.
Hanging over the head of every newscaster is, of course, the dread of one of those times when everything just, well, listen to Bob and Ray.
From the Bob and Ray Communications Center in New York, nerve center of all the vital spots of the world, here we are once again this morning with reports from the far-flung corners of the globe by Bob and Ray's on-the-spot reporters. London, Brisbane, Sydney, and Rome, all of these will be called in from the Communication Center in New York. First, let's travel across the broad Atlantic to the capital of Great Britain and to our reporter there who will give us background information on a story which developed only last night, a story which may affect each and every one of us. Come in, Leslie Leffingwell in London.
This is Leslie Leffingwell in London, England. As you all understand, we are a few hours ahead of you who are listening to this program in New York right now. And as I make this broadcast, it is closer to noon than it is closer to noon where you're listening to this program. The time certainly plays a very important part in the story I'm about to relate, because it should happen about 2 o'clock London time, which would probably give you more or less 2 or 3 more hours before it happens. And I went over to number 10 Downing Street this morning, accompanied by my assistant and several other representatives of the various news services and radio networks, to get the complete full story, and this is it.
I certainly had a terrifying this morning. Something will happen all over the world. There's absolutely no ramifications or anything that could be conceived. I believe it or is advanced. It's all I don't know what to think
or what to say. The people are all aghast. This is Leslie Leffingwell returning you to New York.
And from New York, we reach across halfway around the globe to another key spot of Great Britain's mighty empire and call in our correspondent in Brisbane, Australia. Come in Brisbane and Buford Balloon.
This is Bob and Ray in New York, calling Buford Balloon in Brisbane.
This is Buford Balloon in Brisbane.
This is Bob and Ray. Let's try it once more, engineer. This is Bob and Ray in New York, calling Buford Balloon in Brisbane, Australia.
Foot Balloon in Brisbane. This morning, we were all excited at hearing the news from London, just relayed via Bob and Ray Communication Center in New York from Leslie Leffingwell. We were surprised, I say, and also elated at
Let's
the
try
news.
Once more, engineer, shall we?
Because
this is Bob and Ray in New York calling Buford Balloon in Brisbane, Australia.
Buford Balloon in Brisbane. We were surprised and excited this morning in hearing the report from Bob and Ray's correspondent in...
I'm sorry, engineer. Due to technical difficulties, we are unable to contact Buford Balloon. However, he has submitted to us a written script to be used in the event we couldn't contact him. But upon reading it, we decided not to use it.
Let's go into the frozen wastes of the far north now with one of the expeditions which is attracting worldwide attention. The expedition to the North Pole. And from our correspondent with the expedition, here is a first-hand report. Come in, White Whittlesley, near the North Pole.
This is Whit Whittlesley, near the North Pole. All troops have arrived to within approximately 35 kilometers of the pole itself.
Engineer.
This is Buford Balloon in Brisbane.
And so, from the Bob and Ray Communications Center in New York, once again, we have put our fingers on the pulse of the world with first-hand reports from Leslie Leffingwell, Buford Balloon, and Whit Whittlesley with the expedition to the North Pole. Until next time, keep looking at the news through the Bob and Ray Communications Center.
Another monitor snapshot, and time to play the monitor fun game. It's called simply, What? Yes, What is a new radio pastime designed for each and every member of the family, regardless of age or previous condition of servitude. Now, friends, here's how we play it. We take a sound like this. And you know that one, don't you? But when you hear this sound, we'll ask you, what? Listen. What? Well, we'll tell you what it was right after the station break. Hey, Charlie, get that thing out of here. I mean it. Listen, he looks dangerous. If I've told you once, I've told you 100 times. Don't bring them in here. Look out now.
The Art Van Dam Group, most important quintet around these parts since Batten, Barton, Durston, Osborne, and Murphy. Murphy, you know, comes in at night and kind of straightens things up. Not one to push himself into the limelight much, but I still don't know what they'd do without him. To Chicago and the Art Van Dam Quintet.
On the affairs of today would be complete without a look at science, in this case, astronomy. So sit back with a cup and a flying saucer and listen to Roger Price and Inside Outer Space.
Well, thank you, John. You know, a lot of people ask me questions these days about outer space and what's inside it. Now, we should think about this very clearly. Have you ever stood outside on a clear summer evening and looked up at the thousands upon thousands of twinkling lights from across the velvet panorama of the heavens? And thought that each tiny pinpoint of light represented a sun or a planet or an airplane or a window in a tall building? Now, if you look at the stars long enough, besides getting a crick in your neck, you'll get a feeling of how truly unimportant and insignificant people are. Other people, that is, not you. Today, with the Earth, or Terra, as we always refer to it at the observatory, being threatened by flying saucers and who knows what other dangers from outer space, and with no one to protect us except a handful of granite-jawed men blabbing away at each other and waving plastic water pistols on children's television programs, I think it's time the average uninformed person, you, learned more about the universe we live in. Now, the solar system consists of 9 planets: Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto, which spend all of their time revolving in elliptical orbits about the sun. This whole arrangement, in turn, revolves about the center of our galaxy, an untidy mishmash of over 100 million stars, better known as the Milky Way. Now, you may well ask, what causes all of this ridiculous activity? Gravity, that's what. It's been found that all large bodies, for instance, stars, planets, Mrs. Schwein, and so forth, exert a tremendous attraction towards smaller bodies, moons, meteors, Dr. Schwein, etc. Now, gravity, I have found, comes in handy in many ways. It keeps us from falling off the earth, and it allows us to make drip coffee, and it gives us our dime back when we dial information on a payphone. There is no gravity in outer space, and it is not known yet just exactly how the human body would react under such a condition of no gravity. Anybody in outer space would drift about haphazardly in a state of free fall with no sense of direction, no equilibrium. Now, for some time, Dr. Kitzinger of the Schwein-Kitzinger Institute has courageously been doing research along this line by experimenting with an organic alkaloid formula C2H10O. Now, he drinks a fifth of bonded C2H10O every day for lunch and sometimes remains in a state of free fall for 3 or 4 days at a time. But his notes are pretty confused. The most important part of the solar system, however, is the sun, which is 93 million miles away. Now, here's a little test you can do. If you represent the sun by a large grapefruit or a honeydew melon, whichever is cheaper, and the earth by a number 2 petty point pea, you would have to place the pea 1.75 miles away to get an idea of the relative distance between these two bodies. I'd like to warn you, though, to use extreme caution if you're going to attempt this experiment. I tried it last Thursday, and when I got back after examining the pea, someone had stolen my honeydew. Goes to show you can't trust anyone these days. But actually, though, in computing vast distances such as this, we astronomers don't normally use the term miles, but instead use the speed of light, 186,000 miles per second, which is pretty fast, believe me, boy. In fact, it only takes 8 minutes for light to travel the 93 million miles from the sun to the earth. Of course, it's downhill all the way. The sun is much larger than it has any right to be. It's about 300,000 times larger than the earth. It is 869,000 miles in diameter. Boy, if a man were to start right now to drive around the sun in a car that went 500 miles an hour, and if he drove night and day without stopping, I doubt if he'd make it. He'd probably have heat prostration within a week, if you ask me, as the weather up there must be terrible, especially in the summertime. The sun's function, though, is to radiate heat and light and warm up the planets. If it weren't for the sun, the temperature on Earth would fall to about 1,400 degrees below zero, causing many hardships and readjustments in our way of life. One thing, it'd sure louse up the lettuce crop, and it would eliminate the need for ice boxes and deep freezes. Now, another common question people ask me is, does life exist on Mars? Now, I've observed Mars through a telescope and have spent many hours studying an excellent picture of it on the cover of Astounding Science Fiction magazine, superimposed over a dandy drawing of a blonde girl in a bikini spacesuit. But fortunately, none of the details were obscured. On Mars, that is. The moon, however, is a different story. It seems much steadier than Mars, and it's possible that creatures could be living on the moon, whereas they couldn't live on Mars. Because the moon is round, and people could live up there balanced precariously on the top part, and they might even let themselves down along the sides with ropes. But frankly, I can't imagine why they'd want to. The scenery on the moon is terrible, and there's no atmosphere, water, or plumbing. But there you have the basic facts about outer space. If you'd care to study it further, Dr. Schwein and Dr. Kitzinger will have their telescope finished this month and are moving the observatory to the northeast corner of 42nd Street and Broadway in New York. And they'll be glad to let you look through it at reasonable rates. Moon, 15 cents. Mars, 25 cents. Venus, 25 cents. Window of room 1477 and Hotel Astor, 250. Come early and avoid the rush.
Well, opening night is traditionally one of anxiety for those connected with a Broadway play. And the anxiety does not lessen with the final curtain. The strain continues until dawn or so, when the morning editions hit the street with their reviews. Now, the critics are supposed to know what the public wants, but sometimes they miss. Apparently they missed with a new musical on Broadway, Ankles Away. The critics shook their wise old heads, but the playgoers were delighted. Let's go now to the star's dressing room, where Monitor reporter Al Capstaff is talking with Lou Parker and the Keene sisters.
Folks, Betty and Jane Keene.
I'm Jane.
I'm Betty.
Well, you certainly seem to be getting quite a kick out of Ankles Away. I don't have to tell you that the critics weren't too kind when the show opened on opening night, but they certainly have been proved wrong, haven't they?
Yes, they have, because all of the columnists and the famous TV personalities have gone to bat for us after seeing the show, and it's better publicity than one could ever hope or wish or pay for.
Well, you know, the public seems to like the show, and that's proved by the fact that you're playing to capacity houses. How did you feel after opening night? In spite of the critics, did you think that you had a hit?
We still knew we had a big hit because of the audience reaction to it, not only opening night here with about 5 curtain calls, but the reception that it received in Boston and New Haven to rave notices. Every paper was a rave. Sure. Well, we had quite a few good reviews, too, here.
Hollywood Reporter. Everyone seems to remember the bad ones.
Say, who's this coming in the door now?
Lou Parker.
Oh,
well, Lou Parker.
Hi, Jane, Betty. How are you?
Welcome to Monitor, Lou.
Well, thank you. Thank you very kindly.
How did you feel on opening night, and how do you feel now that you're sure that you're on your way?
Well, I'll tell you, I thought, as Jane pointed out, we had played to 50,000 people up in Boston who loved the show and enjoyed it immensely, had an awful lot of fun on it. So even on opening night when we opened here, the audience reaction was wonderful. People came back, veteran theater goers, people in theatrical personalities came back and assured us that the show went over great. So we thought we were a little astounded by the notices. Of course, critics are entitled to their opinion, but the final judge of anything like this, I believe, is the public. They will either make it or break it, and so far, they've been receiving this show with a great deal of enthusiasm.
They're certainly backing it up, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
Tell me, how did you two, Gerald, come to join Ankles Away?
Would you like me to take the reins, or...
You may, because you being the older sister, I would appreciate hearing from it.
Oh, now, it's only a difference of 6 months.
It's not television, I know that.
This is Jane talking, then. Our voices sound very similar on radio, they tell me. But in November, Betty and I were appearing at the Macombo in Hollywood. And at the time, Danny Shapiro, who was the lyricist for Ankles Away, was writing some material for us for our opening. And after we had opened there, he suggested that we do a musical. At which point we said, well, we'd love to do one, but which one? So he suggested the script of this, and fortunately I had read it because Fred Finkelhoff had approached us about it before we went to London a year and a half ago to appear at the Palladium. So we were familiar with the script. So it happened very fast, and as much as Danny got hold of Sammy Fain, who was then very hot on the coast, he had just received an Academy Award for Secret Love, and he's written That Old Feeling and I'll Be Seeing You, so many beautiful songs. So we were very happy about the combination. So within a short space of time, they seemed to get the book and the complete score together, and they raised the money within, I'd say 3 weeks. Rodgers and Hammerstein have money in it. Joey Lewis, Jimmy Durante, Hal Wallace. 20th
Century Fox.
It has a more interesting cast of backers than actors, I guess.
Daryl might be looking
there you
in.
Are.
Well, the funny part of it is, Daryl put money in it even after dropping my option.
What song gives you the biggest kick? What song do you really like from the show?
Well, actually, it isn't my song. It happens to be my sister's, but I have to be honest. I like Kiss Me and Kill Me with Love, which, incidentally, the Mills Brothers have just made a wonderful recording of.
You slay me. You drive me insane. You slay me. But I feel no pain. You thrill me. So kiss me and kill me with love. You reach me. Your smile is a dart. You reach me. You warm up my heart. You thrill me. So kiss me and kill me with love. All of your love. Though you've got more of that certain something. More than should be love. I adore that certain something. It has me doing nipples on the edge of a cloud. You got me without any strings. You got me above other things. You've got me. So kiss me and kill me with love. Your kind of love. Just hold me, thrill me, kiss me, and kill me with love. Though you've got more of that certain something, more than should be love. I adore that certain something. It has me doing nipples on the edge of a cloud. You got me without any strings. You got me above other things. You got me. So kiss me and kill me with love. Your kind of love. Just hold me, thrill me, kiss me, and kill me with love.
Say, American Motors announces a whole new idea in automobiles.
Introducing the daring, dazzling 1955 Rambler, now on display at all Hudson and all Nash dealers.
So come and see luxury and comfort that's really new in a low-priced car.
See fabulous new Continental styling with brilliant new color interiors.
And, of course, the wraparound. What's the new wraparound, Bob?
Huh?
What do they have that's a new wraparound?
Something besides windshield?
Yeah.
Well, I don't
wraparound.
Know.
Well, we'll Fenders, think of it.
Maybe.
Anyway, you can see the reclining seats. They're genuine hydromatic drive, complete all-season air conditioning that warms in winter and cools in summer.
And all this in a car built with double-strength unit body, safer and free from squeaks and rattles, in a car that's quicker in traffic, faster on pickup.
So take the wheel of the Rambler and thrill to the shortest turning radius of any American sedan, and thrill to the floating smoothness of the new deep coil ride.
And remember, you get up to 600 miles on a tank full of gasoline.
So drive the sensational new 1955 Rambler from American Motors, now at all Nash dealers and Hudson dealers.
Monitor again goes to Chicago for the Art Van Dam Quintet.
This is the NBC Radio Network. Next, we bring you the voice of Queen Victoria on the occasion of the lifting of the mortgage on the Suez Canal. Now, if you listen closely, I'm sure you can hear...
Wait a minute, Ray. I think you're on the wrong page there, aren't you?
Yeah,
according
to
my log here, the next event is music, specifically Darling Je Vous Aime. And weather, Miss Teddy, with an assist from Mary Magoon.
Oh, okay.
Darling, je vous aime beaucoup. Je ne sais pas what to do. You know you completely stolen my heart. Morning, noon, and nighttime too. To your wondering what to do. That's the way I felt right from the start. Ah, Sherry, my love for you is straightforward. Wish my French were good enough. I tell you so much more. but I hope that you come free. All the things you mean to me, darling, Jeroboam or who, I love you, yes, I do. Wish my French were good enough. I tell you so much more, but I hope that you come free. All the things you mean to me, darling, Jeroboam or who, I love you, yes, I do. I love you, yes, I do.
Now, the present temperature is Louisville, 58, Memphis, 67, Miami, 75, Milwaukee, 47, Minneapolis, 52, Muncie, Indiana, 43, Nashville, 68, Oklahoma City, 64, Portland, Oregon, 56, Salt Lake City, 54, San Francisco, 52, Seattle, 51, and Rocky Comfort, Missouri, 55.
It was almost 4 hours ago when we dropped in at the Monitor newsroom in Washington for a chat with Bill Lawrence of the New York Times Washington Bureau. Shortly afterward, Bill sat in on the regular Wednesday presidential news conference. And here, Bill Lawrence talks about this with Monitor newsman Ray Scherer.
All right, John, we're back with Bill Lawrence, the national correspondent of the New York Times. You remember we talked to him last just as things were about to start. I'd asked him what he had in mind to ask the president, and he said he thought it would be, Mr. President, what about your change of mind regarding a Big Four meeting? Bill was the second man to his feet today with a question. How do you think it went, Bill?
Well, I did get a chance to put the question that we've all been interested in. Why was it that 2 weeks ago the president told us he saw no desirability in having a meeting in the summit at the summit at that time, and yet yesterday an invitation was extended by the Western powers for the Russians to join them in such a meeting at the summit. The president's response was that foreign affairs are the kind of business that changes from day to day, indeed almost from hour to hour, and that with the signing of the Austrian peace treaty, seemingly assured, he had also noticed a discernible sentiment throughout the world. He'd seen it in the press, and in the letters that come to him, and in the reports from his ambassadors, that people all over the world had a sort of a vague feeling that some good might come out of such a conference, and that they had decided to go ahead with it, not with the idea that in a few hours, a few days, or a few weeks, the world could be turned around, no indeed, but with the hope and the belief that maybe some good would come of it, as long as you were not expecting too much. He had a very interesting phrase. He said you shouldn't be just stubborn in your refusal to expect anything, but that you should go ahead and see what you can find out about it.
Well, Bill, I take it then you've got the same feeling I did, that what the president was really trying to say today was don't expect too much to come of this conference, but I now think it's worth a try.
I think that's precisely what he was trying to say, that the announcement that such a meeting was to be held conceivably could arouse hopes in the people's minds and hearts of people all over the world that this Cold War is suddenly going to end and peace is going to be here and it's wonderful. He said not at all. He said he was willing to try to take a step forward to see what might come of it, but he definitely didn't want the people to get their hopes up, because if these were dashed, they would be much more depressed than before.
One thing that struck me, Bill, at one point today, he used the phrase, this is certainly experimental. Seems to me that was the sort of the key to his whole outlook on it.
Yes, experimental. And he said, too, that he wanted to get sort of a personal feeling of the atmosphere. He's never met Marshal Bolganin, or if he has, he's never met him when he was the leader of the Soviet Union. And I think he wants to get some kind of a picture of what kind of a fellow Bolganin is and whether or not he can deal with him on a limited basis and expect him to keep his word.
Well, Bill, one general question here. How do you think the president does as a news conference performer under intense questioning such as he got today? I know you've covered both FDR and Truman.
Well, I feel that the president is constantly becoming easier in his dealings with the press. I, frankly, did not think too much of his early press conferences. I think he's getting much better in his ability to deal with questions. I don't mean his ability as such. I mean his ability to deal with questions. And all in all, I've been rather satisfied with the results of the last few months insofar as the press has to deal with the president.
About polio, Bill, how do you think the president came off in his answers about the polio questions? I had the impression he was trying his best to reassure the country about the vaccine.
Well, Ray, I think that in the final analysis, the president summed it all up in a sentence he said to Ovita Culp-Hobby, his Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare, sort of informally at the White House about an hour or two after the conference was over. They were talking about the vaccine, and he said to her, well, I am certainly glad my grandson has had it. And I suppose there, in just a sentence, is sort of thing that would do more to reassure mothers and fathers all over the country who are worried about this thing about the president's own attitude towards it. It was certainly clear. It certainly had much more meaning than the hundreds of words he used during the press conference to try to talk about the situation in more general terms.
Thanks for coming by, Bill Lawrence of the New York Times. This is Ray Scherer. This is a Monitor Washington report.
You know how you're supposed to get a quick chill when someone's talking about you? Well, imagine how it feels when a few thousand people are talking about you at the same time. It's like being out in a veritable blizzard. But we'd like it. In fact, nothing would please us more than to hear from all of you. And here's how you can do it and possibly hear yourself on the air. Call the station on which you get us. Tell them you have a message for Monitor, and they'll record what you have to say. We want to know what you like about us and, more important, what you don't like. Monitor now to Hollywood and a critique.
I'm Bob Hull, radio TV editor for the Evening Herald Express, the world's greenest fish cover. How do you criticize a show like this? I feel like lapsing into the dot system in newspaper ease. It's excitingly different, I believe. The magazine style is comforting and different enough. And it's very effective. It's something like an omnibus, a little bit for everyone. Bob and Ray, I noticed this morning, were very humorous with their Lester Leffingwell and Boy from Down Under who kept getting under. I hope that my maiden aunt doesn't tune in sometime when Buford Balloon and White Whittlesley are coming in with their news comments. I'm afraid she'd get a little afraid. The music segments are a little different from the usual disc jockey type of thing. I think that they can be cut down a little more and interspersed a little more widely. I'd like to see more comedy on the show myself and shorter bits if possible. I was particularly pleased to hear Miss Teddy in the role as a weather girl. Her voice is so soft and easy. I can't imagine her ever getting excited about anything, and I could even take a typhoon very calmly when she tells me about it. Now, the interviews, I believe, were a good point in the show, especially the ankles away. A difference of 6 months in ages? The one from Washington, the last one we heard, Bill Lawrence, I believe that type of thing is going to make the program a real must-listen item for most radio people. The off-the-cuff interview is one of the best things that Monitor can offer, especially in the informality of it. I understand that as spot news occurs, that the Monitor program is going out to cover them. This is a great thing, too. Radio hasn't done this type of thing since that Monster TV came into being. I believe that the costs are down enough now so that they can get out to do this. I'll be particularly pleased to note that more and more of the interviews are used on the show, and not just the taped variety, but the live stuff from all around the world. Now, I think I've used up just about all my time, and if I've been very dot-dashy, I'm sorry, and just one final word. The bloop bleep mambo ought to go over like a ton of rocks. Now, back to Radio Central.
Yakima, Washington. Operation Applejack is approaching a climax. For 4 hours now, we've been getting the picture, feeding the growing climax as the time for the simulated atom blast comes nearer.
For the last hour, Monitor's mobile unit in Chicago has been patrolling that city's famous outer drive with a police escort. The police are there to catch speeders. Monitor is there to report it. John Chancellor has been checking with us from time to time, and he has just signaled that he wants the air. So let's go to Chicago and see what's happening.
It's been a relatively quiet afternoon on the Chicago Outer Drive. This is the period between rush hours. We've been in our mobile unit parked on the North Outer Drive, and we've counted about 60 to 75 cars a minute, which is a lot of cars. We managed to catch the attention of Sergeant Robert Hubert, the Chicago Park Police. Sergeant, thank you for stopping. I want to say where we are again. The Outer Drive is a strip of six-lane concrete that runs for many miles along Chicago's lakefront. You're one of the policemen who patrols this and keeps the speeders.
That is correct, yes. We travel along this Outer Drive here to keep down the speed and save lives and prevent accidents.
Well, how do you catch a speeder? I mean, in all these cars, how do you pick them out?
Well, with as many cars as we have here on the drive, a car doesn't see us, surprising as that may sound to you. They'll go by us, we'll get behind them, clock them for an eighth of a mile or more on our special speedometer, pull them into the curb, and issue them a summons.
If I am speeding or going above the limit and you don't clock me for an eighth of a mile, you can't pinch me, can you?
Well, sir, I wouldn't say that we couldn't pinch you, because if we did stop you in the distance a little less than an eighth of a mile, you probably realize, most drivers do, that they've been exceeding the speed limit.
Is there any particular type of person you pick up most for speeding, Sergeant?
Yes, I would say that the majority of the speeders are in the under 30, I would say, under 30. Most of them are under 30 years of age.
Is a lot of it just not watching the speedometer properly?
I wouldn't say that. I believe they're late to someplace at some time. They're late to someplace.
Wait a minute, I think we've got one. I think we'll see you. We're going to see if we can follow Sergeant Hubert's squad. I don't know if we can or not. We'll get in our unit. Go ahead, Danny. And see if we can follow him. I didn't even see the car that went by. Sergeant Hubert's partner yelled at him. And they've got the red light on and the siren, and I think that it's a white convertible. Now, I'm not sure. But he's in the far lane, and they've gone over on the far left side of this four-lane road that we have here. Watch it. And they're pulling him over. They're pulling him all the way over through traffic. It is. It's a white convertible, a brand-new car with one man at the wheel, I think. We'll be there in just a minute. Of course, they shot ahead of us and got, I think, that whole 8 mile ahead of us in second gear. Yeah, that's it. Here, see if you can pull in beside it. We're going to try, if the driver doesn't hit me in the face, we're going to try and get up there close by and see if we can hear what's going on. Wait a minute. Yeah, here he is.
Driver's license, please. You know you're driving too fast along here. Do you know the speed limit along here, sir?
I don't think I was.
Do you know the speed limit along here, sir? What's the speed limit?
45.
You know how fast you were driving?
Well, I don't think I was going over 45.
We clocked you at 53 miles per hour, which is 8 miles over the speed limit.
Well, I don't think I could have been going that fast. I just turned down here down North Avenue, and I don't see how I could be going 50.
Well,
over
sir,
50.
It doesn't make any difference where you turned on. We clocked you for an eighth of a mile. And our speedometer shows 53 miles per hour.
Well who's this guy here with you, officer? Who's this guy?
Well, we're from NBC Radio,
from
sir.
From where?
From NBC Radio, from the Monitor program.
Well, what is this?
Well, we're interested in all things, and I think you've just gotten yourself a ticket, mister.
Yes,
That was the sound of a crime on the Outer Drive in Chicago, and I'm afraid we're a little bit out of breath. This is John Chancellor, and this is the Monitor Mobile Unit in Chicago.
Well, apparently Chicago traffic is as bad as we're used to it here in New York at 5th Avenue and 42nd Street. That's the traditionally heavy spot. But today, I think that spot has changed somewhat in coming to the studio at about 12 o'clock today and going up the Park Avenue ramp, which is usually the quickest and easiest way to get midtown in New York. The ramp was closed. Fortunately, I had started a little earlier, and I think that is probably the thing to do when you're traveling in New York traffic. Start a little bit earlier. Monitor again goes to Chicago for the Art Van Dam Quintet. Yakima, Washington. Operation Applejack is approaching a climax. For 4 hours now, we've been getting the picture, feeding the growing climax as the time for the simulated atom blast comes nearer. Now again, we go to the army in the field, an army that faces an enemy whose power is unknown and untested. Operation Applejack and the beginning of the end.
Monitor's microphone is now in the driver's seat of an M48 tank. The tank is stopped just short of a barrier put up by the aggressor force in this exercise Applejack. And from this vantage point, we'll try to bring you the sound of the United States forces using a Bangalore torpedo to clear the way through the wire for the infantry that's coming behind. This happens to be a tank that was knocked out of commission in the early fighting and had moved back a bit. We managed to stop it, and it provides us a vantage point for bringing you the sound of the Bangalore torpedo. Those, in case you're not familiar with them, they look very much like a long, narrow, or slender piece of stovepipe, and they come in sections about 5 feet long. Any number of sections can be combined, and the engineers combine the number needed to blow the size hole they want in the barbed wire, and then set it off with a plunger much the same as dynamite is set off. In fact, the Bangalore torpedo is made of dynamite, I believe. It makes a very terrific sound, and we hope that the sound doesn't distort the microphone, but we will stay here in this M48 until they're ready to fire that Bangalore and clear the way. One has been fired already, and when this other is fired, then the 2nd Infantry troops will be ready to move up and continue their attack against the aggressors, driving them toward the Columbia River. This is during the last phase of Exercise Applejack. This morning, the United States forces, having gotten atomic weapons, managed to break through and drive the aggressors back. The exercise will be completed if the United States forces are able to drive the aggressors back to the Columbia River, at which time then the umpires, who are playing such an important part in these war games, will rule on the effectiveness of the 2nd Infantry Division's attack on the aggressors. We're waiting now still while the engineers have set up the Bangalore torpedoes up under the barbed wire. The two reports you just heard weren't the torpedoes, they were some more artillery firing. And that engineering crew that's up working next to the barbed wire is having quite a bit of difficulty with that because they have to stop their work, of course, anytime an artillery report goes off and takes cover. But they'll have the Bangalore set up in just a few minutes, and we'll try to put the monitor microphone out the hatch of the driver's seat here under the turret of this M48 and show you what a Bangalore sounds like. The space distance for a Bangalore torpedo is 300 yards. And even though we're in a tank, we're almost that far away from the site as we sit here. Monitor also, after the Bangalore torpedo, will bring you more information on these tanks. This is the model that's being used exclusively, so far as we know, in the maneuvers by both the aggressor forces and also the United States forces. And we have a very good crew in this tank we're in. We'll try to find out a little bit more about it, so you know what we've been going through and what they have too, and what its capabilities are, and what you can expect from it as another of the fighting arm of the United States. There it goes.
Operation Applejack. Out of the experience of the past, a signpost for the future. Operation Applejack. Dress rehearsal for survival.
You know, Frank, that reminded me just a little bit, and ladies and gentlemen, of an experience I had not long ago. I was at Yucca Flat covering the latest atomic test blast. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to stay as long as was necessary to see this blast. I did see one in 1953 and regretted having to leave, but nevertheless, it has always occurred to me that out there in the middle of the desert, in the dark of night, when you do arrive about 2 a.m. in the morning normally for the test shot, which goes off at about 5 or a little thereafter each time, just after dawn has risen over the horizon, the mountains which always rim the desert, out there in this dark of night, the things that go on that it's impossible to cover by way of radio or television are rather interesting in themselves. Now, our first report to Yucca Flat, Media Hill specifically, a point about 8 miles from the ground zero, the shot tower, On Media Hill, when we arrived there, at about 2 a.m., it was bitterly cold. You always anticipated being quite chilly at night on the desert, but none of us had expected it to be as frigid as it turned out. We weren't dressed for it. And the next day, when I was back in Hollywood temporarily, I stocked up on some long underwear with a good deal of wool in it, a flannel shirt, and a heavy sweatshirt, so I was in better shape the next morning. But in the bitter chill of the morning, the run on the coffee urns immediately exhausted them all. The next day, Civil Defense, and I think they moved very rapidly and efficiently in this, had men going about the whole area, each one carrying a gallon of coffee and a sufficient supply of paper cuts, so that all the reporters, newspaper, radio, television, everyone on the scene had enough hot coffee, had sandwiches, and in each individual case was better able to stand the rigors of that desert night. Dawn on the desert is quite a sight, even before the blast goes off. And expecting it, you always appreciate the first rays of the sun as they come up just before the bomb itself throws its own brilliance on the scene.
Well, I think that's the most vivid picture, John, that I've heard since the blast. And I'm rather surprised, you know, as a matter of fact, when you say that you weren't there at the actual firing of it, that there was anyone there from New York. I know that several men went out and sat there day after day waiting for it, and then finally, for reasons of their own and other commitments, had to come back. But this is certainly a wonderful picture that you just painted. And I also have a little picture of my own of you in your long woolen garments. And I'm sure that you were immaculate, as you always are, and probably with a new tie to match.
Well, Frank, I had something on top of that underwear.
You are listening to Monitor, a new dimension in sound. A link between you and the world as it's being lived this May 11th, 1955.
Monitor, tailored for you. A sounding board held up wherever things are happening. Monitor, your story, you and your neighbors.
You are listening to Monitor.
This is the NBC Radio Network.